This is Ozarks at Large. Robin Marty is an unabashed supporter of a woman's right to an abortion. She is a freelance writer, a lecturer, and researcher. Her book, Crow After Roe, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal and How to Change That, argues restrictions on abortions in many states have made it far harder for poor women to receive reproductive health procedures. Last month, Robin Marty came to the University of Arkansas as a guest of the Gender Studies program in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. She told Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums she selected 11 states' approaches to abortion regulations as the starting point for her book.
The states that we picked purposely to profile are all states that either were the first one to introduce a particular kind of bill. The way that model legislation tends to work is that a bill will be written and it'll be fed out to one legislator in one particular state. Once they see how that goes over in a state, then depending on how the reaction is, they'll start to feed it out to other friendly states that have similar interests. So once you have one bill, the first thing you wait and see is this bill going to get challenged in the courts? That's not always a deal breaker, as we saw with things like the heartbeat bill, which obviously went through, everybody knew was unconstitutional, would get challenged, but they still kept passing them anyway. But with Nebraska was the first time that they ever did a fetal pain ban, and it was done purposely because they thought that Leroy Carhart, who was the provider there, would challenge it, and it would go straight up to the Supreme Court. Since that didn't happen, they then introduced it in multiple other states, mostly in states where there wasn't any actual standing for someone to challenge the bill. That makes the bill look constitutional because it's not challenged at all. All of these states are either the first attempt to try and pass a bill or the first time that that bill has been enforced. By doing that, you can see all of the different legal implications and the legwork that they used in order to find different routes to try and make it up to the Supreme Court and overturn Roe.
That is the ultimate destination, they
hope?
That
is the ultimate destination for a particular group of pro-life activists. We have to realize that at this point, there are two different groups of pro-life activists. On one side, we have the people who are doing what's called the incremental strategy, and that's what I detail in the book. The incremental strategy is meant to overturn Roe, send abortion rights back to the states, and each state gets to decide for themselves. There's another group that is getting more bold because so many laws have passed, and this group wants to overturn everything at once, and they're doing this by means of fetal personhood. And with personhood, what you will do is basically pass a human life amendment that says life begins at conception, goes to natural death, and because of it, there is no sort of bill nor sort of ban. There is no action that can be taken that can stop that life. Those people don't want Roe overturned. They want abortion ended altogether, and they want to go straight for that.
Many of the states that are profiled in your book are what we think of as traditionally conservative. Mm-hmm. Many have wide swaths of rural population. I'm wondering how many opportunities or abortion providers were there in some of these states 20 years ago compared to now?
There's been a huge decline in abortion providers in a lot of states. There's a number of reasons for that. One is the population. The other is the fact that we have much better birth control than we used to back in the 80s and in the 90s, and people use it far more effectively. So there's a lot less need for abortion than there was back then. To have a clinic is a fairly expensive thing to do, especially if you don't have a wide population. And when you have a clinic, especially now that we've seen things in the 80s and the 90s, such as rescue missions where people will try and enter into a clinic and try and stop people from abortion. We've seen the violence that's happened toward providers. And then now with these new bills that we call targeted regulation of abortion provider bills that state exactly how a clinic has to be built, how wide their halls should be, what sort of staff they need to have on, what sort of medical implements they need to have in a building, these drive up the expenses to the point in which you don't have as many clinics simply because it's no longer fiscally possible to have clinics. Another aspect that we see is as Planned Parenthood is becoming more prevalent across the country, because Planned Parenthood can provide abortions and other services, these individual abortion providers will find that if there's a Planned Parenthood that's nearby, sometimes the Planned Parenthood, because it can sustain itself, will take away a lot of clientele and it makes it harder for them to stay open as well. So in some ways, it's the laws that are closing clinics and we see many clinics shut down. In some ways, it's the fact that there's another provider that will help kind of ratchet down how much business another clinic can do. So it's kind of a two-pronged attack that's making providers disappear, but also there's a growing, they call it the grain of the provider, where a lot of people came into abortion services because they either had seen what had happened before Roe, And so they would provide services because they don't want to see women have to turn back to illegal abortions and dangerous, unsafe abortions. As those providers are still there, but we have more medical schools that aren't using abortion as a part of the medical curriculum, we have less people who are trained to do it. So as those older providers start to retire out, we don't have as many younger people who can take over.
The title of the book lets readers know the suggestion, your argument, that what is happening is there is a socioeconomic divide mm-hmm. on services available for women.
There is.
It gets harder to receive, people who are in lower income brackets have a harder time.
It is. And primarily we see that people who are in lower income brackets tend to be women of color. And so those women will have a lot less access to these services. This isn't anything new by any means. The reason that we picked the title and the reason that we did this specifically is that this book only looks at what has happened since 2010. It focuses expressly on a real change in laws that happened. We've seen over 300 bills that have been introduced. We've seen over 100 of them that have passed that have regulated access to reproductive rights. These happened in 2010 because there was such a surge of Republicans elected to state houses primarily and Republican governorships. But this has been a longstanding problem. Women of color, women of low economic standing have always had a much more difficult time getting medical services. They've been taken advantage of much more by the medical industry. Informed consent tends to be brushed by when it comes to women of color. So this has been a long-standing situation that Dorothy Roberts wrote a book called Killing the Black Body that is just a fantastic history of how this has always gone about. And in some ways, this book just kind of grows from that.
This was a divisive issue before the Roe decision in 1973. Mm-hmm. It has not become any less decisive in
not
the 40-plus years since. I'm generalizing. You're making a big statement. Very few people involved in this discussion would tell you they want more abortions.
Right.
Can there be common ground?
I think there can be common ground, and there's a lot of places where we can have common ground. Nobody wants more abortions. What everybody wants on the pro-choice side is we want an abortion for every person who does not want to be pregnant. That's the end goal of it is if you don't want to be pregnant, you should be able to have access to abortion without jumping through a lot of hoops, without having to go into hock, without having to say, I'm going to pull out of school for this semester so that I can use the money to get an abortion. That is all that we want is for that access to be there and for it to be available, not to push people into it, but for people to be able to use. One thing that everybody does have in common is that we want people who want to be pregnant and who want to be able to have their children to have the resources that they need in order to make that happen. We want to make sure that people have health care and health care that will allow them to give birth and not go into horrendous amounts of debt because they're giving birth. We want them to be able to have access to food. We want them to be able to have access to education. We want them to be able to have homes that are safe that they can raise these children in. This is easy common ground for everyone to be able to work together on, and for some reason it's become a divisive issue. Another place where everybody has common ground is that we all want to be sure that there aren't as many unintended pregnancies. That should be a simple one as well. We need full-spectrum sex education to make sure that happens. We need to make sure that we have access to birth control. Yet for some reason, access to birth control is one of the things that's being fought over. Birth control is an easy one. It's preventing pregnancy. This is something that 95% of all Americans will use at some point in their life. That is as common a ground as you can get. Yet for some reason, we're still battling it state by state.
Any statistics that show the state legislatures that have passed the most restrictive laws on abortion and reproductive rights, what the percentage is of men versus women in those legislatures?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I don't have those numbers. I can tell you that places like She Should Run, Emily's List, those are all resources that would have the breakdown of where women fall in state legislators. I can tell you for sure that one of the things we talk about in the book is how important it is that women run for office.
Which, of course, is not to assume that all women.
Of course, not all women are going to be on the same side of the issue. But when you have women in office, you tend to have more people who will support all of the things that lead up to making sure that people can have healthy pregnancies and raise healthy children. Women in office makes sure that people can raise families. And I encourage every woman, regardless of her political political stripe. If she thinks about running, she should run because men just run. We have seen studies that show that if somebody asks a man to run, regardless of his political background, he'll just go ahead and do it. If somebody asks a woman to run, she'll think about it. She'll wait for somebody else to ask her. She'll start with a really low school board or a really easy race to edge her way in. Men just say, no, never mind. I'm going to run for Congress. I'm a businessman. I have a background. I've led people. Women don't do that, and women need to do that.
Even if none of these state laws get to the Supreme Court and then lead to the overturn of Roe versus Wade, there have been great successes, and I would think that many of the people who oppose abortion on any grounds would say that part of their job is already done mm-hmm. because it has become incredibly more difficult.
We have a little joke that we used to use for the title that it's called The Red State War of Abortion. That's kind of my background title for the book. And it's because literally it's a one-by-one state war on making sure that abortion ends state per state. We have some states like Arkansas where that's almost happened. We have one clinic here. There are six states in the country now that only have one abortion provider. One of the examples that I use is in Missouri. Missouri has one provider. It's in St. Louis. And that's the only provider that they have left. Missouri is about to pass a bill that will make a 72-hour wait before you get an abortion. So you would go in, see a doctor, and then you would have to come back 3 days later before you could actually have the procedure. This is a horrible hardship for women who have jobs, for women who come from far away. They would either have to drive hours and hours back twice in 1 week, or they would have to stay overnight for a few nights in the local area. Or what they could do is take another 10-15 minute drive across the river into Illinois, where there's a clinic just 15 minutes further along. If women go and do that and they decide that they are going to have the abortion over in Illinois, they've just legally ended abortion in Missouri without actually doing it. What they call it is undue burden, and it's a standard that's set up by a separate law or a separate legal case called Planned Parenthood v. Casey. In it, it said that a state has the right to restrict abortion as much as it wants, especially if it's in the interest of a woman's health, so in so-called informed consent, where you provide her extra information, waiting periods, so she has more time to think about it. As long as there is not an undue burden, then a state can pass any law that it wants. What all of these laws in the books are about is testing what does undue burden mean. Nobody's entirely sure what that means. It's not a clear legal definition. So when we see states like Texas, where they've passed a bill that is going to close almost all but five clinics in the state, is that an undue burden? Is it official that abortion is legal in a state as long as there's one clinic left to access that abortion? That's the fight that we're going to be having, and that's the thing that the Supreme Court is going to decide for us. When is abortion technically legal? Does that make it a right?
In the past several years, we've seen some shift on marijuana use and legality, especially with medicinal marijuana. Mm-hmm. We've seen a big shift on the attitudes towards same-sex marriages. It's becoming legal in state after state almost monthly.
Right.
What have we seen as far as social attitude towards, and it's a broad issue, but towards abortion or reproductive rights?
It doesn't tend to shift. A lot of what we've seen in Gallup polling ever since abortion was made legal is that there's a fairly even split between the idea of pro-life and pro-choice. And when you look at those labels aren't helpful, and that's probably why there's still such a split.
Sure, because there would be a difference between someone who would, say, support the morning after pill.
Right.
And someone who would support abortion later and everything in between.
Right. So the labels don't help, and so it's not an easy way to decide how people feel. One of the things that I use to explain why it seems that we're stuck in the mud with abortion attitudes is the fact that, and this is a really, I mean, it's not a family-friendly way of looking at it, but when you look at the civil rights issues, and civil rights changed once people realized that you were born in the skin color that you had and it wasn't something that you could choose. Now we're seeing a massive shift on GLBT rights and gay marriage because people are more widely grasping the idea that this is not a choice that people are making. This is something that they are born into. The reason that we're not seeing the same shift on abortion rights is because people still firmly believe that when it comes to being poor, when it comes to not having access to things, it's not because of something that you were born into. It's not because of inherent issues that come with racial inequality. It's because you're not trying hard. Being poor is something that you can fix. Being poor is not something that you can choose, and being being poor is something that is morally less. Because of these attitudes, most of the abortion laws that we see aren't stopping abortion for everyone. They're stopping abortion for people without means. And the idea is, if you really want this abortion, you should have to work for it. It goes along the lines of people saying that abortion shouldn't be used for birth control. Nobody wants to use an abortion for birth control. Abortion is not comfortable. Abortion is not easy. Abortion is not cheap, as birth control is. But you have to work for this abortion. If you're not willing to work for it, you haven't earned it. If you were poor and you did not have the ability to get birth control in the first place, being pregnant is your fault. It's this type of attitude that makes it impossible for us to fully shift the entire discussion when it comes to reproductive rights.
Robin Marty is the author of Crow After Row, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal and How to Change That. She spoke last month on the University of Arkansas campus as a guest of the Gender Studies program in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. While in Northwest Arkansas, she talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.